Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series.
You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Watch Hacks, streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look out, it's only films to be buried with. Hello, and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a psycho killer, and I love film. As Patrick Rothfuss once said, there are three things all wise men fear: the sea in storm, a night with no moon, and the anger of a gentle man. Oh, and Hereditary. That is fucking terrifying. A really scary film. Yeah, it is actually. Patrick Rothfuss. Fair play. You're right. Every week, I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died. Then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Kevin Smith, Sharon Stone, Jameela Jamil, James Acaster, and even Ked Pambles. But this week, it's the incredible Mr. Chris Addison. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you'll get an extra 30 minutes with Chris. We chat about openings and closings. You get a secret from him. You get even more of the whole episode uncut and ad-free as a video. You get all sorts of stuff. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Big news this week, if you missed it last week, I will be doing a live Films to be Buried With at 5 o'clock on the 3rd of July at the Underbelly Festival in London. That is the 3rd of July, 5 in the afternoon. Is that early evening? Call it what you like. It's at 5. You better be there. I'll be there with an amazing guest. We'll do a live show. And then at the end, we'll do a Q&A with the audience and you can tell me the films that meant the most to you. It'll be cracking. Your two TV missions, as always, are to watch season 1 of Ted Lasso on the Apple TV Plus app and season 1 of Soulmates on Amazon Prime. One will make you very happy. The other will make you question your partner. So, Chris Addison. Chris Addison is a stand-up, he's a writer, he's an actor, he's a producer, he's a Hollywood director. He's had the most amazing career. He's made The Thick of It, he's made Veep, he's directed Anne Hathaway in Hollywood movies. He's done all the things you could dream of doing, and he's done them all excellently. This recording was our first conversation ever, and I've got to say, he was a fucking delight. I think you're going to love this one. We recorded it over Zoom, and for once, both microphones were excellent. This is the best sounding podcast I've done in ages, so you'll enjoy that. That is it for now. I hope you are all well, and I very much hope you enjoy episode 148 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is me, Brett Goldstein, and I'm joined today by an actor, a writer, a stand-up comedian, a producer, a creator, a director, a hero, a legend, and a human being. Please welcome to the show the incredible, the amazing, I can't believe he's here, please welcome to the show, it's Chris Addison!
Oh, thanks, man. You know, I also once worked in a sandwich shop, if you just want to update your
list. I know, and I fucking kicking myself because I'd learned the list and I got to the end, I called your name and I was like, fuck, sandwich shop.
Yeah, prick. Sorry. Yeah, there you go.
I'm so sorry.
Those were the golden days.
How are you, Chris Addison?
Do you know what? I'm all right, actually. It's been a really weird bit, this bit, because we're recording this now at the beginning of May. So it's the point where there's sort of light at the end of the tunnel. And I found that bit to be weirdly harder. I don't know how you have responded, but that's, I found it to be harder than the other lockdowns because I don't know why. I think it's that thing where you let yourself relax before you should relax. know?
Yeah.
But I've sort of come out the other side of that now, and I'm now just sort of feeling like it'll be what it'll be.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm all right. How are you?
Yeah, I was like, yeah, no, this is cool. This is cool. We're going back to normal. This is cool. And then I got on the tube the other day and like 50% of people weren't wearing masks and I was so stressed. I was just sat there so stressed. And I thought, nah, I'm not quite as relaxed as I thought I was.
Do you remember when 2005, right, when the bombs went off in London? And yeah, people were very kind of like, I don't think I can go on the tube. And everybody went on the tube. And within 2 days, we were absolutely fine with it. But now it's completely different. Because then you were going, right, hang on, who might be trying to blow me up? And how can I approach this in a non-racist way? And and now you're just basically going, everyone's a fucker. Like, they're all out to kill me. It's much worse now. For some reason, it's much more stressful, so even true, though the danger is less dramatic.
Yeah, that's very true. That is. You have been currently, I believe, you're writing season two of Breeders?
Yeah, season two of Breeders. Yeah, it's going out in the States at the moment on FX, and it's about to go out on Sky later this month over here. Season three. So I've just done another writer's meeting for that. It's all sort of underway. I, as the person who generally, like, although I didn't do it last season, normally I've done them. I say normally. How can you say something normal when you've done it once? I was on the reg. I was doing the second block of filming I was directing. So for people who don't know, quite often with long series of stuff, you would divide those into blocks because it's too much for one person to direct and get done in time to deliver it all for the channels and so on. So I would do the back end of the block, which is where all the time's been spent and the money's gone and the scripts aren't ready. And so it's sort of comforting to feel as we go into our sort of third season writer's room, if we get picked up, that, once again, it looks like the back end will be not as ready as the front end. But I like the back end. I like to pick up the back block because that's where the juicy stuff happens, you know.
Yeah, it's nice to work with a group of people who are simultaneously exhausted and in a mad panic.
Yeah,
that's absolutely the time to join.
I sort of feel like that's what you train for as a stand-up, you know, like, yeah. I mean, that's sort of what Edinburgh is, isn't it? The Edinburgh Festival is an annual really SAS style training in being so tired and with so much pressure on you. I sort of feel like, yeah, it's kind of, I've got the
Edinburgh
muscle
is
memory.
The final block is the final block.
Yeah, it is the final block.
So you and Martin Freeman created the show, correct?
Me, Martin Freeman, and Simon Blackwell,
Simon Blackwell,
who runs the show. Yeah, the brilliant Simon Blackwell. Yeah,
and he runs it. He's the showrunner, is he?
He is the showrunner. Yeah, he's the he's the mastermind, because he's just the most astonishing writer, Simon. He's so insanely talented, and he's got this very particular voice. This is so, I love watching Back. I don't know if you've seen Back, you know,
yes,
the Mitchell and Webb,
brilliant,
which is Simon's show. And because it's just like, when I listen to David Mitchell's character and Uncle Jeff, played by Jeff McGiven, it's just like listening to Simon, basically. I just can hear everything that he's, yeah, that's Simon talking there. He's great. So he's our showrunner.
Oh dear God, you've frozen. Oh no.
What do you want to do when we freeze? Do you want to kind of roll back so that you can edit it for filming purposes, or do you want to just carry on, make something?
This is the brain. This is the brain of someone who's done a lot of Edinburgh.
How are we going to? The brain of someone who has done a lot of Edinburgh is basically self-protection, I think, is what it gives you, don't you think? Like you just learn over the years of doing Edinburgh how to do it in a less and less destructive way as you get older and your body gets capable of taking less shit. I
found every Edinburgh, that me going insane happened slightly later. That's all.
Now, that's interesting. When did it happen? When did it tend to happen to you?
First solo show. Before I did solo shows, didn't happen. I loved it. Yeah. Then as soon as I started solo shows, I'd say 3 days in, I was insane on the first one.
Oh, wow.
Second one, a week in. Third one, 2 weeks in. Fourth one, 3 weeks in.
That's interesting. I used to sort of find that it was the latter end, which I think is to do with just the amount of time that you're there and the sort of,
yeah,
just what your body and brain can cope with. I remember often giving the piece of advice to people who are going up to Edinburgh for the first time, saying, you will go loopy and you just have to accept that that's going to happen, so that when it happens, you know, oh, yeah, this was always going to happen. And you can find someone to talk you out of your tree. But if you know it's going to happen, it's sort of better than if you if you think, oh, my God, this is it. I'm not made for this. Everybody does it, don't they? So it's all
and it's
of us.
So mad, and no one cares. And I remember, I think one time that I was, I remember being in the Brooks Bar when the London riots were happening.
Oh, wow.
And there was a TV on somewhere, and it was showing, like, literally London is on fire. And I remember looking at it, and then someone going, I got a really bad review in Chortle today. I don't think this matters, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, it's such an incredible bubble. But there's that panic, isn't there? There's that sense that, oh, God, if I don't go, that's it. All momentum is lost. I'll forget about who I am. And I always think of, there was a year that I didn't go, 2003 it was, I didn't go. God, that was 18 years ago. My agent was going, you've got to go, Chris, you've got to go. It's really important you go. If you don't go, people are going to forget about you. All this effort you've put in over the last 5 years will be lost. Oh shit, I should go. And I didn't go. And I remember I was at Lord's Cricket Ground watching England play South Africa, watching Nasser Hussain's final test match as captain. And I had a copy of The Observer, and it was a beautiful sunny day. And I was there with my wife, or my about-to-be wife at that point. And we were having a brilliant time. And I read the reviews from Edinburgh. I read a review for my friend John Oliver. And it said, the reviewer said, reminds me in some ways of Chris Addison's show. And I thought, see, I didn't need to go. Like, I didn't need to go.
Right.
Yeah, it was so perfect.
That's so funny.
I just didn't. And then the next year when I did go back in 2004, people go, yeah, that show you did last year, meaning the one 2 years before. They don't care. You can take the time off. It's fine.
It's a scam. The whole thing's a scam.
It's a scam. Oh, and the money. The money
you can make in Edinburgh. My God.
Oh, shit. There are people, I can remember friends of mine, like, having such bad years in Edinburgh that by the time the next Edinburgh came around, they hadn't paid off the previous one.
Yeah. Have you stopped stand up? Do you still do stand up?
I certainly haven't decided that I've stopped stand up. Right, I've just not done it for quite a while now because other things have sort of got in the way. For quite some time, I used to think the next thing I do will be write a show or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's only in the last 3 years or so that I've come to accept that that's probably not going to be the next thing that I do at any given moment. But I do feel like it's something that I want to go back to do at some point. A couple of weeks ago, I did Andy Zaltzman's podcast, The Bugle, for the first time. And it's the first time for me in, like, I don't know, 8 years or something that I've written something that was for me to deliver. And I loved it. Like, I fucking loved it. I was properly in my element. And it reminded me of, on the sort of rare occasions that I ever get on stage to do anything, how you just sort of suddenly go, oh, this is where, this feels right. This is home. This is where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah.
I don't know when it'll be, but I fully intend to do it again.
Well, I'm glad to hear it.
You're Chris. Right. What's happened?
Chris, I've forgotten to tell you something.
What's happened?
Oh, no. No, what an idiot.
This doesn't sound good.
Dope. I should have probably said it in the initial email.
Yeah.
Or at least when we connected on the Zoom, I'll just say it. You've died. You're dead.
Oh, shit. I have no idea where any of the paperwork is for a start. Mind you, it's not my problem, is it?
No, it's not your problem. I feel bad for the cleanup that's going to have to happen. But how did you die?
Well, I mean, I suppose if I had my way as to how I would die, I would die like most people who aren't Vikings. I would want to die, you know, comfortably warm, surrounded by people I love gently, and, you know, with a sense of contentment. However, I suspect that the truth is that I will die in a pickle-based explosion. That would be my...
It seems inevitable, to be fair.
I eat an awful lot of pickled food, like a huge amount of pickles and chilies, and pickled chilies as often as not. And I do feel on many afternoons that the way I'm going to go is some sort of overindulgence, vinegar-based overindulgence. That's what will kill me. So I will explode.
You'll explode from the inside out.
Yeah, I will. From the inside out, I will be killed by a combination of chilies, some of which, and pickles, some of which I have made myself.
You know, it's a lovely way to go. The more disturbing part of the setup to this was the death that you wished for, which was surrounded by people that you love gently.
That I gently said. Love, yeah.
Not people that you love hard. So you don't want your favourites. You want the people...
Yeah, you don't want to upset your favourites, do you? You want people you sort of who are comforting to you.
Right.
But, okay. You know, it would be upsetting to look into the face of your nearest and dearest as you die and you know that you are leaving them with a hole in their lives.
Yeah, that's so thoughtful.
Yeah, I'm a good guy.
Like Simon Blackwell would be there, I'm guessing.
Simon would be there. Yeah, Simon, that'd be nice.
Love him
Simon
gently.
Would be there. Yeah, yeah, he'd be there, I guess. A couple of pets that I've had over the years would probably be there.
Just the gentle lovers, any lovers you had.
Just some gentle. You wouldn't want any ex-partners there, I don't think, would you? That would be a hell of a way to go, just surrounded by your ex-partners.
Well, I'm assuming your wife's not going to be there.
Well, no shit, I love her too much, you see. So she doesn't make the cut, does she? So I wouldn't actually have the people who are most important to me in my life. No. Around me at the time, they would be. I don't know where they'd be.
They're probably out. You're just in the next room, just going, why can't we come in? No, he's been very specific. He loves you too hard.
Yeah, it's too much for you. You're in the overflow watching on a TV.
What he has asked is if you could start working on the paperwork while he's.
That would be great. In fact, they're going to be. There'll be a big screen in Trafalgar Square, and that's the overflow. Yeah. So they'll go there with many of the other people from the nation.
That seems fair. Do you worry about death?
Massively, all the time, increasingly. And I say increasingly, and that started from a baseline of quite a lot. I think about death all the time. And it's not healthy. It's like, you know, thinking about aging all the time. It's really, really unhealthy to think about it. I've been dinner with my best mate, well, before the pandemic, obviously, and he was going, we're just getting too old, Chris. We're getting too old. And I was thinking, but this is as young as we'll ever be again, right? Right now is as young as we'll ever be again. So you have to approach it from that point of view. But it is really hard to tell yourself that stuff. You can sort of intellectualize it, but on a visceral level, the fear of dying and of getting old, and that's hard, isn't it? That's hard. Yeah. I'm properly kind of at the point in my life where I'm ripe for a midlife crisis about now. So
have you got any particular plans for it?
I think I might be already. Like, I'm such a boringly wholesome person. My friend Rebecca described me as that she's the most wholesome person I've met. And I was thinking, you know, within me, I've got the same dark thoughts as everybody else. I'm just possibly not brave enough to act on them. So I would probably, I'll take something up. I'll start learning something. I'm probably already doing it. I'm trying to learn German. I expect it, you know, that's like a function of the midlife crisis, isn't it? Like in a really mild way.
That's so funny. I mean, that is so, I don't even know you. And I know that you learning German is the exact right answer to what would Chris Addison's midlife crisis look like.
There you go.
But listen, it's good to stay consistent with your brand, and
I didn't lie about any of the things about myself. I didn't make up this kind of milk toast persona and think this is what people enjoy. I'm just going to put all of my bravery and raw sexuality in a box over there and be this kind of willowy fuck for business purposes. That didn't happen, Brett. This all from me.
That's wonderful. Tell me this, what do you think happens when you die? Do you think there's an afterlife of some kind?
I do not think there's an afterlife of some kind. I'm very sorry to have to report. But I did for a very long time imagine that there was such a thing and came quite late to the notion that, do you know what, there really isn't anything else other than what we've got.
Was there a thing that happened that made that decision for you?
It was a very long journey. So I brought myself up religious, sort of. That sounds like an odd thing to say, but I chose to go to church and do things like that. And that was largely attached to friends of mine who were going there from school, who were going. And also music. I was always, I sang a lot when I was a kid, and that was a place you could do it. And I just sort of, there's a series of fantastic detective novels set in like 15th century Spain, the Captain Alatriste novels. And in it, the narrator says this, that the only thing I ever remember about them is this line, a man's true home is his childhood, right? And I think of it all the time because I sort of didn't lose religion for a long time because it was comforting to me as an item of nostalgia as much as anything else. You know, the things that I did that were important to me as a kid, some of them, not by any means all of them, but some of them had religion at the heart of them. And so I sort of, as I got older and it became more and more obvious to me slowly that there was nothing in it, I just held on to it as long as I possibly could. I was sort of intellectually an atheist long before I admitted to myself that that's what I was. And then I was in my mid-30s. I was right at the end of that process. And I remember listening to this fantastic American comedian called Julia Sweeney, who did these terrific one-woman shows, including one called Letting Go of God. And I listened to Letting Go of God. And at the end, she describes her journey from dyed-in-the-wool Catholic to complete atheist. And it's a really interesting journey where she's trying to reconcile her spirituality and find some sort of meaning and all of those kinds of things. And at the end of it, she tried everything and she goes, okay, well, let's just imagine for a second just that there's some spectacles you can put on and that way you see the world and through that there's no God, right? That's the version of the world that you're looking at. So it's just a thought experiment. Mm-hmm. She said, and I put the spectacles on and I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, there is no God. And I can remember where I was when I was listening to that. I was walking down St. Martin's Lane next to that old, it's not there anymore, but that film memorabilia shop that used to be on St. Martin's Lane, you know? And I was exactly there when I heard her say those words and I did the exact same thing in that moment. And that was the moment where I went, that's no. And it was really strange for the... Following that, it was peculiar. It felt very raw.
Was it like you were grieving?
Well, one of the things she says is really interesting. She says, when you decide there's no God and there's no heaven and there's no hell, it means that all those people that you said goodbye to, you have to say goodbye to again. Because all the people that you said that they've gone on to a better place, I'll see them again. You accept at that point, oh, no, that's not going to happen. Like, they're gone. And I'm a very fortunate person in that I haven't thus far in my life been, you know, struck with a great deal of personal tragedy or anything. But, you know, she certainly had, and, you know, her brother had died and so on. She felt like she had to let go of him again. And I sort of, so there is a grieving aspect to it, but it's also like, what do you do? Like, if you always on some level thought there's something beyond this, it's fine. This is just a bridge to the better world or whatever. What do you do when you decide, oh no, this is it. Every decision that you make has to be sort of made on a slightly different basis. This is very heavy, isn't it? I didn't mean it to get so heavy.
This is exactly the good. This is the good shit.
Okay.
What is your answer to that?
I think and there's nothing terribly profound that I can say about it, not least because I'm not a thoughtful enough person to be that profound. But I think it's just you've just got to be as good a person as you possibly can, and you've got to accept that you get one go at this, and you're not doing it for somebody else or for some other purpose. You're doing it for you, and that could be, well, the way you want to live your life is for the sake of others or whatever, but there isn't a set of rules that's going to get you into a better place. And you should, you know, there's nothing that you should be dealing with right now on that basis that should be informing your decisions about what you do and how you behave to other people.
Chris Addison, I find that fascinating. I found that very moving. I find that really interesting. But I got news for you, kid.
What's that?
You are wrong.
I'm wrong.
Oh. You idiot.
Be honest with you.
Heaven? Yeah, go on.
That's a massive relief.
Yeah.
Like, it's huge relief.
Because that whole bit was real downer. And
the gift is every... Yeah. It was such a downer because, like, if you just turn this on because you just want to hear some chit-chat about some movies you might like and some fucker is telling you there's nothing else, that is not what
he's lying. He's lying, guys. Don't worry. I got this.
It's such a relief.
There's a heaven, man, and it's great. And they got the, you know, where that film memorabilia shop you used to like on set?
Yeah.
Is there.
Oh,
it's in heaven.
Oh.
They got screening rooms. They got all your favourite things. What's your other favourite things?
Pickles. It's got, they've got a lot of pickles.
Pickles everywhere, and they ain't going to kill you.
It's, non-deadly it's pickles. Oh.
And everyone is delighted to see you. They're very forgiving as well that you'd thought they weren't there. They think it's fun. They're like, that's delightful. Come on. And you're like, ah, and it's beautiful. And they want to know about your life, but they want to know about your life through film.
Okay.
And the first thing they want to ask you is, what is the first film you remember seeing, Chris Addison?
The first film I remember seeing, Brett Goldstein, is... Well, the first film I remember seeing on the TV, mm-hmm. I can't tell you what that was. I can tell you what the experience of it was. I remember visiting somebody's house, and I was with them in the same room as their gran. Their gran had a little room, and she was watching something on the telly. It was a Western, I think. And I can remember as a tiny child... It was on ITV, this thing, and so they're just constantly having commercial breaks. And I can remember thinking as a kid, when is this going to end? It's so long. Why is this TV show so long and boring? Oh, my God. Why would anybody make anything this long? As a kid, it was used to like 5-minute episodes of the Wombles or whatever at this point. It just seemed impossibly indulgent that people would do that.
This is pretentious.
What the fuck is this? Just shoot him. Yeah. So that was the first experience of watching film I can remember. The first film I remember seeing in the cinema, I saw back in the days when Disney used to re-release their films on a fairly regular basis. So this probably must have been in the 70s. But Cinderella. I saw Disney's Cinderella
Stevenage. Is that where you grew up?
I did not. I grew up in Manchester, yeah. but my gran Omar, as I call her, she lived in Stevenage in a little block of flats there. So yeah, so we went to see, me and my brother and sister and her went to see Cinderella.
Where are you and your brother and sister?
I am the oldest, and then my sister, then my brother. But we're all within, I'm 2.5 years older than my brother. So that, like, my mum was busy, man. It's only when I became a parent that I went, Jesus God, I mean, that must have been brutal. 3 under 3.
Yeah, that's insane.
It's a lot. No. I'm surprised I wasn't in the cinema all the time. You know, just go in there. Just go in for an hour and a half.
Take the other two. Did you love it? Did you love the cinema? Did you love Cinderella? Do you remember
that? Yeah, I can remember. I mean, I really loved the cinema when I was a kid. It's just, it was such an event. It was so extraordinary just to go, even to watch adverts on the big screen was amazing. I remember really loving the Westler's hot dog adverts because it seemed so exotic because it was big. It was big. Yeah. It was all big and there and in front of you. And I used to go to, there used to be a little cinema called Unit 4 in Walkden near where I grew up. And it had, you know, what I realised now were like shoebox sized cinemas, you know, those tiny, tiny wee things where I went and saw like Convoy and Hooper and all of those sorts of movies. Yeah. Yeah. I saw Hooper and Convoy in a double bill on my friend Chris's birthday.
Love Hooper. I used to love that.
It was great.
I always wanted to be a stuntman.
Did you? Hooper.
Yeah.
Until
still my dream job. No, until nothing. I still want to be. It's just, it's a real closed door.
Those guys have it all sewn up. It's who you know.
Nice shop, yeah. What's the film that scared you the most? Do you like being scared?
You know what? I absolutely hate being scared. Hate it. I cannot bear horror. I don't understand the point of it. I don't want it to exist. I wish it would go away. I just don't think it's a good idea. I remember going to see Get Out, which is a brilliant movie. It's a brilliant Absolutely movie brilliant. With my friend Tess Morris. And it was lovely. We went to my favourite screen in the world, which sounds very pretentious, but fuck it. There's a cinema in Los Angeles called the Cinerama Dome, which they announced 2 weeks ago is closing down because it's not going to reopen after the pandemic, to my great regret. But anyway, we went and saw Get Out there, but as we walked in, I was thinking, what am I doing? Why am I here? This is fucking stupid. I'm gonna soil myself in public and it's gonna be awful. Just clinging on to Tess is going, what the fuck is wrong with you? I'm terrible. So I avoid scary movies. by and large. I think the film that made me most tense, which is probably as close as I get to scared in things generally, is probably it's Gravity. That's the most tense I've ever been watching a movie. Because I mean, I know everybody says Uncut Gems. I've still not seen Uncut Gems. I know it's supposed to be just you know, if you held coal in your hands whilst watching it, you'd end up with diamonds at the end of it. Like it is that. But Gravity, I can. My wife and I went to see it. We were like, it was really indulgent. We did it at like 10 o'clock in the morning. There's nobody else in the cinema. Nice. It's a big cinema, 3D screening and stuff. And that's a great film to watch in 3D because of everything just coming at you. Oh my God. Until she puts her foot on the floor at the end, I was terrified all the way through it. It's great. I don't mind that. But horror, scary, stuff that can revisit you in your dreams, fuck that shit.
Well, you live in a godless world. It is scary. Right, you don't need any more amen, terror.
Brother. Amen, brother. I really try with those sorts of things to go, okay, well, let's watch this from a filmmaking perspective. So how have they done this? What shots are they using? How many set up? And I can keep that up for 17 seconds. And then after that, why are they doing that? Yeah.
Right.
No, not for me.
What about crying? What's the film that made you cry the most? And do you cry?
Well, it's just a real shooting fish in a barrel job, though, to be honest with you, because I cry all the time. I mean, I cried all the time before I had kids. And once you've got kids, it's nonstop. So you have to put the right music under something and you've got me. So I had to think quite carefully about what this was. I want to give like an honourable mention to It's a Wonderful Life, which is such a sort of weepy movie. It's happy weepy, I think. I remember going to see it with a friend of mine at the Curzon in Soho, which is one of my favourite cinemas in the world. It's such a lovely place. And they sort of reissued a print about, I don't know, 15 years ago, something like that. And we went and watched it one December. And I remember going to the loo straight outside the screen afterwards, and it was full of men going, and just really holding everything back into the, I can't, what? And that you knew that they just belted out away from, I'll be right with you, dear. Just not joining themselves with their girlfriends and their wife and their daughters before coming back and their friend. Yeah. So It's a Wonderful Life always gets me. But I think the one where I really fell apart was about in 2003, I think. I went to Australia to do the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, God's Own Comedy Festival. Good Lord, what a place. And I did the road show, which happens after the festival. Tour around a gang show around Australia. And I was with Adam Hills and Cal Wilson. And I remember Cal being a good Kiwi insisting that we go and watch Whale Rider, and I nearly died. I mean, yeah, I was kind of like, it's like a cornflake at the end, dehydrated. There's no liquid left. I don't know if it would do that again. I mean, we, you know, it was late, we were drunk, it was very emotional. But
did you all cry together?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Adam Hill's very sensitive, lovely dude. Yeah, Cal, you know, it was right in her wheelhouse. Yeah, we were a wreck, pathetic wreck. Well, I quite like that, though, given there are some aspects of, you know, there are some comedians who are a bit kind of, who would not be there for that at all. Yeah. But we're definitely the softer
that's
end.
Very nice. What is the film that people don't generally like? It's not critically acclaimed, but you love it. Unconditionally.
I had to think quite hard about this. I really still like So I Married an Axe Murderer.
I love that film.
Yeah, it's a great film. There are things that come back to me. I think often of woman, woman, woman. I think of that all the time. And I think of Heat, move your big Heat, all the time. Those two things just stay with me. And I know it's sort of flawed. I think this was in my head because this weekend I showed my kids Austin Powers
Oh, really?
Yeah. You do. It just make you go, God, this is, couldn't make this now. But
did they like it?
Yeah, they did like it. I sort of felt like, I wonder if they got enough of the sort of cultural spoofing that was going on. But you know, there were lots of things that they did really like about it. My kids sort of they sort of sit there and they talk back at the jokes often. Why would you do that? They go, like, they're laughing, but they go, why has he done that now then? Because that's how this stuff works. It's really sweet.
How old are your kids?
Well, they're older than that makes them sound.
21 so both, and 22.
They're both film directors in their 40s. but they really like, they sort of, I don't know whether it's me picking jokes apart that has made them do it. I don't know whether like I have infected them somehow with my kind of, the boring way that you can be about comedy when you're in comedy. I hope it's not. I hope I haven't ruined it for them. But anyway, I wonder whether that's why So I Married an Axe Murderer in my head. I also thought maybe Con Air, which.
I fucking love Con Air as well.
Well, it's a great film. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's an entirely ridiculous film, and it's got all of the things that make a film like The Rock great, and just doesn't do them as well. You know, I mean, it just doesn't quite do them as well. And there are things that you sort of feel like that thing. What is it? Giant rabbit that he wants to
put
take
the bunny down.
Yeah, all of that. And, you know, like, it just feels like something out of a film writing manual, that give him the thing. Yeah. He's got to focus on some little thing. Got to give him a thing to focus on. And it's this ridiculous. And it sort of feels like they watched a lot of Die Hard and they watched, you know, The Rock. But it's got Malkovich at his absolute campest, which is always great fun. I can watch John Cusack do pretty much anything.
You've got Cusack vibes.
You know, it's interesting. That's not the first time that's been said. And in fact, there's a scene in The Sure Thing. I can't believe I haven't got The Sure Thing on this list somewhere, which is an amazing John. It's Cusack's first movie, produced by Roger Birnbaum, who I worked with and is an extraordinary man. Yeah. And anyway, but there's a scene where they're trying to get into a caravan and the rain is just throwing there. And he turns around to snarl something at Alison. And he looks, and I remember watching it about 20 years ago and going, fucking hell, because he looked exactly like me. I was genuinely shocked in that moment. A young Cusack very much looked like a young me. We've gone our separate ways since then. I've had quite a lot of work. but otherwise, I'm sure we'd have been the same.
I'm going to give you So I Married an Axe Murderer because I love that. Really, really love that film.
Yeah.
It's got a very funny one-off scene with Michael Richards in it. It's a really good, really funny game that is played. Good stuff.
Yeah.
What is the film, on the other hand, that you used to love but you've watched recently and you've gone, I don't like this anymore, for whatever reason that may be?
Honestly, I can give you a sort of a mini category, really, and then I'll give you the biggest example, but I think it's basically late period Roger Moore James Bond. Like, I loved it. So the first Bond I ever saw was the Spy. No, it wasn't Spy Who Loved Me. It was For Your Eyes Only, which I saw at the Unit 4 in Walkden on another friend's birthday. And
in another shoebox.
Yeah. And I absolutely loved it. Loved it. And it sort of started a proper kind of lifelong love of James Bond, which is not an unusual thing. Many people love James Bond. It's a big cultural phenomenon, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, Roger Moore was my first James Bond. And I would watch on bank holidays after that. I can remember sort of mainly watching his stuff that was on. It was The Spy Who Loved Me and it was Moonraker and all of those kinds of things. But the truth is that you can sort of go, oh, they're good though. They're tremendous sort of high camp. You have to think of them as different to Sean Connery and different to Daniel Craig. And yeah, that's true to a point. And then there's E.G. Octopussy, which is just dog shit. I mean, it you know, like, it's badly made. As much as it's massively offensive on so many levels, it is incredibly badly made. I can remember years ago, my friend Will, you know Will Smith, you know, not
yeah,
the
I love Will Smith.
Well, Will Smith, but you know,
yeah,
to Will
Smith,
lovely Will Smith, brilliant comedy writer, former stand-up. Years ago, did a document, just wrote a document trying to unpick Octopussy, and it's one of the funniest things that I've ever read. Every few years I go, well, have you still got that? Can you resend me that thing? Because I defy anybody to sit and make sense of the plot. It has absolutely no through line whatsoever. And it's also just from a filmmaking perspective, unbelievably, but you just said, where was the director during this? It is so shit, as well as being wildly racist. And it's the kind of peak of that, when James Bond went a bit Russ Myers-ish in terms of its sexism. That's like Octopussy, the absolute zenith of that. So I think that's the one that I would use. But that's very much a part that tells a whole, really. I still love lots of James Bond, but that is terrible.
I think that's a very good answer.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Stadtsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series. You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with Hacks writer and actor Pat Regan, on how their improv experience helped them when shooting scenes and what it was like writing scripts for specific actors.
You'll also hear from crew members like the costume designers on what it was like creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Hear stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and more. Watch Hacks streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
What is the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily the film itself is any good, but the experience you had around seeing the film will always make it important to you.
Yeah, well, I'm going to choose between two here. One would be Yellow Submarine, because when I was a kid, it blew my tiny mind. Like, I could not believe, like, it was so exciting. It was the Beatles, and it was so colourful, and it's really appealing. And I loved the little fluffy nowhere man, Jeremy, and I even loved the Blue Meanies. Like, it was so, and I found them sort of terrifying as a little kid. And I can remember getting the video for it a few years later when I would have been in my mid-teens, I suppose, and watching it every day, one Easter holidays, watching like every single day. I loved it. Many years later, I introduced it to my own children, who sort of loved it equally. I like it for being a film that I loved so much as a child that I was able to introduce to my own children and for them to love. Like, I love it that it's a through line. The other one that I would choose for a similar reason, and I think you might appreciate even more, something tells me, is A Muppet Christmas Carol, which... I think it is an astonishing movie, A Muppet Christmas Carol. Like, on every level, it's incredibly well done. A friend of mine who is a big Dickens fan says it's the most faithful adaptation of A Christmas Carol. And yet it's completely a Muppet movie at the same time. It's the best Muppet movie. And that's it's quite a high bar. There's a lot of great, the original Muppet movie and James Bobin's amazing The Muppets and so on. There's a lot there that's great. But A Muppet Christmas Carol is like, it's now our family tradition. I remember going to see it when it came out in the cinema. I was at college at the time, at university, and remember seeing that with friends then, where you didn't see The Muppets much in those days. Like, they weren't around everywhere, and there wasn't YouTube to see everything on, and they weren't on the TV anymore, and they were a big part of my childhood. And then suddenly this phenomenal movie came out, and then now it's a massive part of my own family life. So each year, like, that's the official start of Christmas for us, is we put The Muppet movie on. And then a few years ago, my kids had their school choir for their Christmas show, they did songs from that movie. They did A Christmas Carol, they did songs from that movie and various other ones and so on. So it's kind of woven into the fabric of my family life. So I think of the two, I would probably end up choosing Muppet Christmas Carol.
I'm only holding myself back because people who've listened to this podcast have heard me talk about Muppet Christmas Carol so much.
Really?
It is true. No. I love what you said. I mean, I'll say it again. I genuinely stand by top three greatest films of all time. It is one of them. It's aside from everything that is wonderful and perfect about it, It's a fucking amazing piece of filmmaking.
It's an astonishing piece of filmmaking. From that from the opening shot, that extraordinary opening shot over London, they pull that off so well that you don't, you know, you do see as you come down that it's a change. But to have a model, which is what it was then, a model that big, for it to go for so long over those roofs and then come down, is magnificent. The trick of having, I love the Muppets. I'm sure you've talked about this, but I love that one of the things that Jim Henson wasn't involved in that film by that point, but one of the things that the Henson organization loved to do is innovate and find a new exciting way, so that in the original Muppet movie, I think it was the original one, wasn't it, where they're on the bikes. First one. That's right. And that's kind of, how have they done that? Even the opening of the first Muppet movie, where he's in the swamp singing Rainbow Connection. It's like, how have you done that with puppets? And with Muppet Christmas Carol, there's that wonderful, very simple but brilliantly effective rolling road barrel where Kermit and Tiny Tim are coming home singing, and it's a superb piece of filmmaking. Now let me ask you this: what are your views on the revisionism towards Muppet Christmas Carol, whereby an entire song has been cut out of it?
Oh yeah, I think the song should be there.
You do.
And I think it's, and I believe it is going to be put back in on Disney Plus. I believe that there was a whole issue with them having lost the original, but now they found it and it's going to go back in. And I read a whole piece about how none of them wanted to cut it. It was an executive who was like, it's too depressing. And they fought. And basically, I think the exec eventually said, look, I've let you do everything you want to do, just cut that song. And so they cut it. But it shouldn't have been cut.
I mean, the crazy part is
It was on the VHS, but not the British cut.
I remember seeing it's not a song I enjoy massively. I do think it's important that it's there because it makes total sense at the end of the movie when they start singing the love we found. You need that. That's a reprise. You can't have a reprise when you didn't have a prise. So you know, so you have to put it in. But it sort of reminds me of there's a similar song in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Truly Scrumptious sings Lovely Lonely Man, and it is ghastly. Like, it's just, oh, God damn it. You just think, it's good that we live in a world where we can fast forward. And to an extent, Belle's song in Muppet Christmas Carol always sort of made me feel like that, so I could see why they cut it out. But you absolutely have to put it in. And it affects the rhythm as well. It affects the rhythm of that last section is very truncated. As a result, one of the things that I love about it is how terrifying they're prepared to make it. So the ghost of Christmas yet to come is genuinely terrifying to children.
And the ghost of Christmas past is very spooky and sort of, it's such a great idea.
Always reminds me of the angels as they first come out of the ark at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yes. I think it's filmed with a similar, I'm pretty sure they filmed those things underwater. The way that the way that the material is flowing, that's what it sort of feels like. And so the ghost of Christmas past always makes me think of that in Muppet Christmas Carol. But it is, I know, I think top three greatest films of all time. I'm totally in your corner with that.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I'll tell you one other thing on this subject that you may not know. I'm sorry if I've said this before, but I definitely haven't to you. There is a deleted scene. I think about this a lot in Austin Powers 3 Goldmember.
Right.
There is a deleted scene, which is the song, What's It All About Alfie, but it's What's It All About Austin. And it's a montage of everyone singing What's It All About Austin. And I swear down, it is genuinely moving. It's such an amazing sequence.
Really?
It's beautiful and it's funny. And it's like one of the, I basically think it's the best thing that was ever made of Austin Powers. And it's not in the film. And the reason it's not in the film is because when they did test screenings of it, people were so moved by this song bit that they never laughed again.
Wow.
so they just cut it. And it's so interesting that. They were just like, the film never recovers from that song.
That's extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, you find out big things when you're test screening.
Mm.
I find it absolutely staggering. Having made a film, I find it amazing that, like, where you and I come from, right? Our stand-up shows are tested and tested and tested to be an inch of their lives. You know, it's the cheapest possible art form, the thing that we do. And we put everything into making sure that that is as bulletproof. I mean, nothing's bulletproof in the world of comedy, but as bulletproof as it can be, you just make it right. Now, you make a film for tens of millions of dollars and you, I mean, you do test it, but like you don't have an awful lot of wiggle room. Not really. Like you, you might have to, in fact, well, unless you are prepared to spend millions and reshoot, which is what we ended up doing. And I know lots of films end up doing, but like, that seems crazy to me that you don't go into filming thinking, okay, all right. So that $30 million is our budget. Why don't we say we're going to make this movie as a $20 million movie. And then we'll leave $10 million to allow us to test and reshoot and rejig. That to me seems sensible because there's no other creative process where you have less kind of ability to change the body of the work that you're doing. Does that make sense?
Completely. And I've never heard it put like that. And that's so interesting. And how did you, were test screenings for you when it's your film difficult and ego destroying and horrible?
Or it's like a wire brush to the soul.
Right.
I mean, it really, they're really hard. You know what it's like, right? You've done, okay, I'm going to go and do a preview. Right. Okay. I'm going to do a preview. And that was fucking humiliating. You know, it's an hour where I was, oh, well, probably less because there's no laughing. So it was 45 minutes where I was on stage and they just weren't going with anything. And I think I just, this, I'm not going to sleep tonight. That was ashes. You know, this, like, we're used to it. It's a thing. But nonetheless, like, it's a private thing to some degree where it, where we then take it away and do what we want to do to it. But once you get to a stage with a film that you're testing things, there are an awful lot of kind of voices in the room at that point, and it's not yours anymore. And you're to blame when things are, when things don't go well. So it's, it is hard. And, you know, if you think about where the testing process comes, so you've had your 10 weeks or whatever it is, you and the director and the editor have had their time to do their cut. And that's the first thing that's tested. So you're really invested in it by that point. You've gone, you've done an awful lot of fine tuning to this thing. And then you put it in front of people. And it is, it's an amazingly brutal process because, well, for all sorts of reasons. One of the things, there are two things they do that make you go, oh, Jesus. One is they film the audience, right, with a like heat camera. They film the audience and then they give you a file afterwards that is, you you get the audience, you get what they filmed of the audience, and in the corner is your movie. So you can see exactly how they're responding to what what moments. So you are watching people going, and then you're watching them going, right. And it, I mean, it's horrific. I mean, it's incredibly useful. Like, it's exactly what you need, but it is, Jesus God. And then the next thing they do is they, they've given everybody in the test screening, 300 or 400 people, whatever it is, they've given them a bunch of cards with questionnaires on them. And they give you those the next day. They give you a, like a breakdown of how it went. And then they give you the cards and they break the cards down into sort of into demographics. So they're like four demographics, women of younger women, older women, younger men, older men, or whatever. And then they, you start to read them. And so me and my, and Anthony, my editor, were sitting in the, like in a lobby in a cheap hotel in LA the day after we'd done the first test screening. And they sent these things to her. And I went, okay, I'll open it and I'll read them. And the first ones are going, this is fucking brilliant. This is the most fun movie I've ever seen. I love this movie. This is an amazing movie. And you go, oh my God, we're golden. We are golden. This is great, right? But what they haven't told you is that they give you them in order of enthusiasm. Oh, so shit. As you go through the cards, they get less and less enthusiastic until by the end of it, you're in your car going, this is a piece of shit. Who allowed this? So this is the worst movie I ever, and you know, and you're just, you're just weeping. It's absolutely extraordinary. It's an extraordinary process.
Do you have any, how do you survive it emotionally? And like, how? What's your, do you have any advice?
I think you just have to, you just got to fucking toughen up, man. I mean, like there's nothing that you can make that everyone will love. Like there are, it doesn't matter how popular or successful something, there are people who don't like Taylor Swift. There are people who didn't buy Adele's album, or some people who bought Adele's album and went, sorry, I suppose. That like, there's no way that you can get out of that. I have a cartoon that I often send to people. It's on my desktop, actually. And it's of, you'll appreciate it. It's two panels, right? The first panel is the view from the stage when a comedian's on, and it's the mic in the stand. And beyond that, like, there's just everybody laughing and there's crying laughter, and they're hugging themselves and they're having the best time. And then the second panel is what the comedian sees. And it's the mic and everything else is blacked out, except there's one dude who's got fucking furious, right? Now, you know this. So yes, this is, and the amazing thing about this cartoon is it's in exactly the same place that fucker is always sitting, which is always, as you're looking from the stage, on the left. Yeah, down on the left. Always, yeah. Right?
Always. That's where they sit.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Always. Isn't it extraordinary? Always on the left, always about three
near
rows back. Yeah. What the fuck? Every time.
What is that?
Yeah, that's the seat. That's the fucker seat. Like they got the cunt seat on Question Time. There's clearly one. Well, are you really not going to? You look like you're not going to enjoy this. I'm going to sell you C6.
C6. Cunt.
Anyway,
yeah.
There's a good lesson in that cartoon, which is that you're always going to fixate on the negative responses. So you just have to not do that. And I think, you know, it depends on what you're trying to do, I suppose. If what you're making is great art, then you probably don't want to test it anyway. You just want to put your vision out into the world and see how that goes. But if you're making something that is intended to be a commercial success, then you have to understand that, well, that's the game that you're involved in, and you need to try and do everything that you can to make it that. So it's useful to have people tell you, that's shit, mate. So long as it's clear enough, what they're saying is clear enough and absolute enough. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing worse than, I don't know what this note means. I don't know what that reaction tells me.
Tell me this. Are there things in the film that, like, that tested badly, but you 100% believed in them, sort of fought for them, like, no, they're wrong. This audience is wrong. I'm sorry, this bit needs to stay.
No, not really. Like, in fact, there's one that's the opposite, because there was something that I absolutely fought to do that is not in the film. Like, I fought so hard for it to happen. And because we reshot the beginning of the movie. The film is, for people listening, there's a film called The Hustle that I directed. So the opening of that movie, we had to not quite the opening, because the first thing that happens post titles, the first time we meet Anne Hathaway's character, we had to reshoot it because we'd done this thing that I absolutely loved, but in it she scams this kind of sweet but super rich nerd, played brilliantly by Tim Blake Nelson, who's so good, and I just loved him. I thought it was wonderful, but when we showed it to people, they've sympathized with him, and she came across as a horror, and her character just never recovered as a result of that. So we had to kind of redo it where there's somebody who deserves to be ripped off, which, you know, so that's, but the whole section, because he's a nerd, it had involved her as this kind of super spy character where she'd gone out onto the veranda of this casino, and she's doing all these kind of, like, she's like a glam Jason Bourne is the part she's playing. She can't remember anything. She's just washed up. She's got this scar and she does all these incredible kind of acrobatic tumbles. There's a bit of gunplay with the police inspector who's secretly on her side and all of this. And it took us 3 days to do it. It cost God knows like $1 million or whatever. It was, I missed some very good friend's wedding because it overran this thing. And it never made it into the movie because it was part of this sequence that actually on reflection, it made total sense, of course, that was the wrong opening.
The things that I can't enjoy now that I understand how things are made are things like battle scenes in Braveheart, for example, where I just go, how the fuck did you reset? How the fuck did you reset 100 horses and spears and run? What do you mean there was a take two of that? Like, how does that happen? I cannot get my head around it.
What's the film? Is it A Bridge Too Far? Was that the Richard Attenborough one? There's one of those big war movies of that era that Richard Attenborough directed. I think it is A Bridge Too Far, and it's like there is the one scene where it's they're trying to take the bridge, and the parachutists are coming down, and all that. And they had like, I think I'm probably misremembering this wildly, and that speaks most likely to my own fear as somebody who has sometimes to make things that, like, I think they had one chance at the entire thing, and I think it was his money. And I mean, some of that stuff is incredibly high stakes, and it's the whole it's the whole game, isn't it? Like, you are, yeah. If you don't get that, you, it doesn't matter what else you shot. You haven't got anything. It's terrifying, isn't it?
Anyway, this is all fascinating. Tell me this, a little change of pace. Chris Addison, what's the sexiest film ever made?
I think it's Out of Sight.
Correct.
Am I right? I think you're it correct. Is. Oh, good. That's good. I do really think it's an unbelievably sexy movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is some sex in it, but not in a way that it's not remotely pornographic. I think there's only one sex scene possibly in it, but the...
Yeah, there's a Don't Look Now sex scene in it in terms of time going backwards and forwards. And but they are both fit as fuck.
They are both fit as fuck. And there is that, and that, my friends, is chemistry. Like, it is so, it is so extraordinary. Chemistry on that. I remember being really disappointed with what happened to Jennifer Lopez's career after that, because I just thought that was the first film, wasn't it? And I remember thinking, God, you got, that's brilliant. What a talent. And then she did. And I speak of somebody whose favorite genre, I make no apologies for this. Although the fact that I've said I make no apologies for this is sort of an apology, but I don't make any apologies. My favorite genre is
not apologizing for you.
It's rom-com. It's romantic comedy. I fucking love romantic comedies. Leave me alone. But she was in, like, her choices were terrible. Made in Manhattan and all of those sorts of things. But in that first movie, it's so good. And I think Soderbergh is interesting, isn't he? Because, like, he'd made Sex, Lies and Videotape, which I don't think is a very sexy film.
No,
like,
it's not a sexy film.
It's not at all a sexy film. It's sort of the opposite of a sexy film in many ways. Yeah. And then he made Out of Sight, and it is just like the tension is extraordinary. It's extraordinary. That No More Time Out scene is amazing, because it's sort of where he's at the top of the stairs, isn't he? And she's down, and they kind of it's beautiful because all of the stakes are in that scene, and it's an I love you scene, and it's a we can't get over our jobs scene, and there's also still that tension there. It's a remarkable piece of filmmaking.
Love it. Love the soundtrack. Chris Addison.
Yes. David Holmes. It's an incredible soundtrack.
Riddle me this. There's a subcategory to this question. Troubling boners, worrying wide-ons. What's the film you found arousing that you thought maybe you shouldn't have?
Well, I've got two. I've got two to choose
from. Great. I thought you were going to tell me. I can't answer that.
I've got two to choose from for slightly different. They just, you shouldn't be. One of them is Betty Blue. Right. Now, Betty Blue is undoubtedly a sexy film starring Beatrice Dahl. And if you're a man of my specific age, she was the heartthrob, and particularly for kind of, for sort of indie boys of my age, she was on all kind of university hall walls, right? Yeah. She was stunning, Beatrice Dahl. But that character is so damaged that it sort of feels wrong. Like, it feels really wrong. It's really not, you shouldn't be finding that person sexy, because that's, her sexiness is an expression of how badly damaged she is. That is why that's a troubling movie. And the other one, which is also, you shouldn't be that, come on, man, is Ex Machina.
It is the sexiest.
Yeah.
Ex Machina.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is so wrong. Like, it's completely wrong. It's about, because the movie, although it's sort of framed as being about our relationship with technology, it's not at all. It's really about men and women and the way that men view women. And that's what really you're responding to. So you just, as they sort of progressively make the android more and more human, it's, you sort of feel yourself going, please don't go any further with this, because this is, I don't feel good about myself. And then it just gets worse and worse and worse, that thing. And at the end you think, well, I probably would have deserved to be trapped in there as well, to be absolutely honest.
It's a bit like Vertigo, I think, in that it sort of goes, you'll fall in love with her because you're an idiot.
Yeah.
Because you're all idiots.
Yeah.
And you will fall in love with it.
Are you a heterosexual man with a dick? Yeah. Well, here's a film that's going to make you the fool that you actually are. I mean, it really is. Come on, please don't do this to me. Oh, you did it. I know. I did it to myself, but it's very, very troubling. I mean, really troubling. I felt bad about myself after that movie. But to be put that into context for you, Brett, I feel bad about myself most of the time for a range of different things.
Sometimes a movie can be on and I'm not even watching it. I'll still be feeling bad about myself.
Yeah.
What's the objectively the greatest film of all time?
Objectively the greatest film of all time.
Might not be your favourite.
Well, I think it might be The Rock. Okay, I think it might be The Rock. I think The Rock is arguably the best made movie. I mean, it's just an astonishing piece of filmmaking because it treads such a brilliant line between utter high camp. I mean, just it's so camp. It's so camp they would turn it away at the Vauxhall Tavern for being a bit much, right? It is that camp a movie, and yet it is also this extraordinarily kind of macho thing where the characters are so appealing. In it, every character is right. You know, they're all the right version of that kind of person. Sean Connery is exactly the right version of the cynical, wisecracking old lag. Nicolas Cage somehow convinces you again that he's a putz when he's clearly not. One of the first things you see him do is that, you know, he's got this beautiful girl that he's making love to. And you go, oh, okay. So this guy, so we're supposed to think of this and a motorcycle. And so this is a nerd scientist, but somehow, anyway. Somehow he's cool, and that's brilliant. Ed Harris is a fantastic villain.
He's got a point as well, which is unusual in these things.
Yeah, absolutely. It includes the most over-the-top climax. It's just that end with Nicolas Cage on his knees with the flares. You know, and those jets have had time to get to Liverpool by the time they actually hit The Rock. It is so... Come on, guys. Yeah. But I mean, it's just an astonishing piece. In the same way that people often say on this podcast, you know, in the same way that Die Hard or Back to the Future or whatever are really incredibly well put together. I would also I would put in those categories My Cousin Vinny, because I think it's a masterclass in how to write a movie. It was Dale Lorner who wrote Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Who wrote My Cousin Vinny. And it is, I really recommend it as, I know Back to the Future is the one that people always say, and you should definitely look at that if you're interested in how to write a script that everything ties up in. But My Cousin Vinny, nothing is wasted in that movie. Every single piece of information that you're given comes back and serves the payoff. It is just great. It's a great, and with some phenomenal performances at the center of it. So I would put that up there. You know, do you know what I mean? Like Groundhog Day as well, those ones. Pirates of the Caribbean. Yeah. Just everything fits.
Very good.
I'm going to go with The Rock.
You're very good at this, actually, Chris Addison.
That's a relief.
You're very good at this podcast. What's the film you could or have watched the most over and over again?
Well, it's a dead heat. I mean, I'm not sure which of these I have watched most, but these are the two films that I've watched most. And you know, when I said, my friend Rebecca said, I'm the most wholesome person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, these two films are When Harry Met Sally, which I can do at karaoke for you. I mean, again, another astonishing script.
Yeah.
I can do that entire film. And the other one, here you go. The other one is A Room with a View. I've seen A Room with a View, I would think, 30 times, I reckon. I've seen that film. I'm probably the person who's watched that film most out of everybody in the world.
You've probably watched it more than Merchant and Ivory.
Yeah, I don't think during the editing, James Ivory saw it as much. I loved that. I saw it at a film club at my school, sort of when it came out in 85, something like that. Entirely fell in love with Helena Bonham Carter. That was a big thing in my life at that point. And really subsequently. It's so incredibly charming. It's very, very funny. It's a proper, I love a coming of age movie, and it's a coming of age movie, really, and a rom-com as well. As being, you know, obviously you sort of think of it as being an Edwardian period piece or whatever, which it is, but it is those other things as well. And I love coming of age movies. That's sort of my Gregory's Girl, you know, that's in there in my sort of top 10. And anything that is somebody fully becoming themselves. I'm into that. And Room of the View is sort of that, but it's utterly charming.
Excellent answer.
Yeah.
I don't like to be negative. I don't know about you. We've talked about it. It's very hard to make a film, but
yeah.
Let's do it quickly. What's the worst film you ever saw?
Well, I'll give you an answer in private, but for now, putting my professionally courteous hat on. Well, there are two movies actually that I'm gonna put up here for. I mean, it's really hard to make something at all, obviously. Yeah. However, I do recommend, if you can find it, that you go and look at the 1990 version of Captain America.
Oh, is that a trauma film? Trauma?
No, I don't think it is. No. I think it's actually like it's a proper studio.
Okay.
What did on it? It is. It's just baffling. It's sort of, especially now when you watch, you know, we're so used to seeing Marvel movies and how much money is spent on them and how wildly professional they are on every level. When you go back and watch something that is so cheap that they're not really able to do any of the things that you're supposed to do in a superhero movie. So like, it's genuinely bad. And the story is awful. It's like, it's only an hour and a half or whatever, which is really pretty good. I think more superhero movies should be an hour and a half. I'd be there for that. But it is, it's clear in lots of places that they're having to point the camera in a certain direction. We can't look at what's behind us. So just, if you could just all do that in that one direction, that would be fantastic. Thank you very much. It is extraordinary. So you should definitely seek that out. But, and this is another superhero movie. This is objectively the worst movie ever made. It isn't my opinion. It is plainly, it's there for you to see on the screen, the worst made movie of all time. And it's called, it has two names. It's either called Iron Hero or Metal Man. Okay. Now, I really would recommend that you try and track down a DVD of this. Somebody with about $250 has tried to make an Iron Man ripoff. And they've done that not only, I mean, and in some regards, you want to go, well, that, good for them. That is incredibly brave, brilliant that you're going to back yourself. You know, talent will out. Storytelling is the most important thing. But the story is dog shit. The acting is genuinely appalling. But you're really watching something that someone has made in the flats of their mate. Like what rooms are available to them? I can't really describe it. Well, I can remember. I saw it, and my sister and her husband, I was staying with them whilst I was doing a gig, and they went, "Oh, you come back after, and we'll watch this movie." And I don't think I've laughed as much in many, many years. So it's Iron Hero or Metal Man. Look it up. It is so
worth
it. Had
they bought it because, had they seen it before they showed it to you?
They knew that it was going to be absolute dog shit. Okay. Yeah. And it is genuinely terrible. Nobody involved in it is at all talented. And that sounds so harsh until you watch it. Like somebody should have taken everybody to one side and gone, guys, there's no good outcome here for you.
But you were entertained for an hour and a
half. That is absolutely true. That cannot be denied. So in fact, it might be the greatest movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, thank you.
I totally reversed my position. It's a work of fucking genius. I do recommend watching it.
Okay. You're in comedy. You're very funny. What's the film that made you laugh the most, other than Metal Man or Iron
Other than Metal Man or Iron Hero? Yeah. Well, I think like the film that's made me laugh most cumulatively over the years is The Naked Gun, because one of my bonding moments with my best mate when we first met at university in like the early 90s was that our student union was showing the first two Naked Gun movies, and we went and watched, and we both knew them so well that we were laughing. You know, when you're laughing in anticipation of the joke, which is one of my favorite, when you're enjoying something so much, despite having seen it 84 times, that you're really looking forward to the funny thing that's coming up. We were clutching each other and giggling, watching that, and have been firm friends ever since. So The Naked Gun, I think it's hard to, pound for pound, it's hard to think of a funny movie.
You can totally have that.
Thanks, man.
Chris Addison, you've been astonishing.
Yeah, you're very kind.
I've loved this. However, when you were eating a lot of pickles, right? You were eating a lot of chili pickles, and you got a little rumbling in your tummy, and you thought, and your wife said to you, "I don't think you should eat that last pickle." Yeah. And you said, I'm going to eat it. I know I'm going to eat it. So my suggestion is you pop in the next room, start looking for the paperwork you're going to have to do. I'm going to just put a quick call in for the people that I love gently. I'd like them to gather around. So Simon Blackwell, some old friends from school. Not your best friends from school, but the second tier.
Yeah, people I like. Yeah, second tier.
Second tier come in. You look over Twitter. Kind of people, you know, I love these people. Gently, they pop over. Trafalgar Square, I send a note out that, hey guys, I think it's coming. So then a big gathering of people you cared about or didn't care about are in Trafalgar Square. Your wife and kids are there now because you love them too hard to be near you. And you find a couple of enemies, some people from the test screening that said, how dare you be alive, whatever. They gather strategically in the room. Anyway, you eat this final pickle and you explode and your blubber connects with the people that you don't like. And
that's good.
It hits them in the face. But the people you love gently, they're spared. Anyway, I was walking by your house and I hear this horrific noise, which then was followed by a loud, long fart. And then I chuckled to myself. And I thought, that's fine. This must be Chris Addison's house. I pop in, I got a coffin with me. You know what I'm like? Anyway, I'm clearing through the people you love gently. There's loads of them, actually. You're a very loving man, but gently. And there, I find you're an absolute fucking mess. The state of it. I'm having to peel bits of you off people you didn't like. There's stuff in the curtains. I'm having to take down the whole curtains because I can't get it off. Everything's pickled. Anyway, I stuff all the bits of you into the coffin, but there's far more of you than I was expecting, what with all the soft furnishings that's come with you. Stuff you all in the coffin, right? There's barely any room in there. There's only enough room in there to put one DVD that I can slide in the side with you for you to take across to the other side. And when you get to heaven, it's movie night every night. And one night it's your movie night. What film are you taking to show the people of heaven when it is your movie night, Mr. Chris Addison?
If it's movie night every night, I think this would be an interesting movie for us to watch. And I rewatched this at the weekend to test whether I still loved it as much. And I do. We would watch Night on Earth. Do you know Night on Earth?
Jim Jarmusch. The taxi film.
Yeah.
The taxi film.
If you have not seen Night on Earth, it is the most entertaining. It's so perfect. It's an incredibly entertaining movie. It's about one night. As Harry always used to do. One night on Earth with five taxi drivers at the same sort of period of 20 minutes. And their stories. So it starts in LA and then New York, Paris, Rome, Helsinki. And it is just, you know, five completely unconnected stories other than the fact that they take place in taxis. And it's really, really lovely. Really lovely. And funny and sort of soulful and bittersweet. All the good Jim Jarmusch stuff. And it's a really good example of that sort of early 90s art house stuff that I quite liked.
Really, really good. Now, Chris Addison, before we say goodbye, is there anything you would like people to watch for, look out for, listen to, anything? Breeders, I believe, is on its way. Breeders 2?
Yeah, Breeders. Yeah, so that would be Breeders season 2 is currently every Monday night on FX in America. You can also catch up on FX on Hulu. And you can also see season 1 there. In this country, the United Kingdom of Great Britain, and for now, Northern Ireland, you can see that on Sky starting on May the 27th. And it will also be on Now, or as Now TV is now called. And you can catch up on Sky and Now on the previous season already.
Brilliant.
Also, have you seen Ted Lasso?
I've seen
totally
it once.
Watch Ted Lasso. Yeah, not your sort of thing, was it not?
Not for me, but
not for me.
I appreciate the thinking behind it. Chris Addison. A delight.
Thanks, man.
God bless you. Have a lovely death and see you soon. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you.
So that was episode 148. Head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 30 minutes of chat, secrets and video with Chris. Head to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star rating, but don't write about the show, write about the film that means the most to you and why. It's a lovely thing to read, it does help numbers, etc., and it is really appreciated by my neighbour Maureen. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you to Chris for doing the show. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lyland for the photography. Come and join me next week for another incredible blinder of a guest. So that is it for now. In the meantime, have a lovely week and please be excellent to each other.
Sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.